When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On the podcast today, Arun Kudnani, the writer, discusses his most recent book, What is Anti-Racism? And why it means anti-capitalism. Joining Arun in conversation is Ruchira Sharma, the writer and journalist whose work has appeared in outlets including Vice and The Guardian. She's also co-host of the Everything is Content podcast. Let's join Ruchira Sharma and Arun Kudnani in conversation now.
I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, Arun Kudnani. He's a writer interested in issues such as racial capitalism and Islamophobia. He is the author of books including The Muslims Are Coming and The End of Intolerance, which was selected as a New Statesman Book of the Year. His most recent book, What is Anti-Racism and Why It Means Anti-Capitalism, is what we'll be discussing today. So the first question I wanted to ask you is, how effective do you think modern approaches to racism are?
I think the first thing to say is that we actually have two different traditions of anti-racism, right? So when we talk about modern approaches to racism, there's one that tends to get most of the attention, which is what I call a kind of liberal tradition of anti-racism. And there's another tradition that's a little more hidden called a radical anti-racist tradition, right? And I think that the liberal tradition, we can kind of get into defining those terms a little more precisely in a moment if you want, but the liberal one has kind of run its course. And at this point, I think is more harmful than helpful. And most of the stuff, you know, if you work in a large company or in a university or a government department or something like that, and your experience of anti-racism is diversity initiatives that have become familiar to most of us, I think now. That is the liberal tradition of anti-racism, and I'm afraid I think it's doing more harm than good right now.
So can you talk about what liberal anti-racism is, and why do you think, you kind of mentioned this in the book, why has that become the dominant definition of anti-racism at the moment?
Yeah, so the best way I think to sort of capture what liberal anti-racism is about is just to think historically for a moment, and actually, the word racism as a kind of word that's regularly used in the English language really only goes back to the 1930s when we were trying to make sense of Nazism and understand something called racism as central to it. And the sort of theory that emerged around that time, and you know, if you want to have some citations here, it would be people like Magnus Hirschfeld, the German Jewish sexologist and queer theorist, Ruth Benedict, the American anthropologist, Franz Boas, the American anthropologist. You know, people like this were thinking about this idea of racism in a new way at that time. And what they came up with was essentially this theory that feels very familiar to us now, but was new at the time, which was that in a country like Germany in the 1930s, you had large numbers of people who had been taught in schools that there was a racial hierarchy in the world, that there was maybe four races, and the number always varies. You know, is it three races? Is it four races? Is it seven races? Because these are unstable concepts. And that there was a hierarchy among those races with whites at the top and so on, right? And that this was the sort of scientific orthodoxy of the 19th century, but by the 1930s had been scientifically discredited. So to hold on to those beliefs after that point was irrational, right? So is that racism is essentially a matter of irrationally held beliefs. And so so what is anti-racism then? The anti-racism then looks like credentialed elites, scientists, academics, what we might call opinion leaders today, have a responsibility to persuade the masses that their prejudices and attitudes and beliefs with regard to race are now irrational and should be amended, right? And that is what the problem of racism is, right? And so the solution is this kind of top-down approach where, and it's an educational approach, right? It's about saying you need to be educated about something that you currently don't fully understand, right? And so there's a straight line, I think, from that moment in the 1930s of people explaining how Nazism comes to power right through to the present day with, you know, diversity training, you know, various kind of educational initiatives that are designed to like make us understand our unconscious biases and get rid of these irrationalities that are present in our mind. You know, the 4.3 billion industry around diversity training in the United States, I think all derives from that. So does the idea that if we just get our representation right in Hollywood movies, then that has this kind of educational effect on the general public to get rid of their racial attitudes in that way, right? And so I think all of this in the end actually boils down to this new way of thinking about race that comes out of the 1930s, which, you know, for a good few decades, that while that was not everything that we ought to have been doing in terms of anti-racism, that was going to be a part of it, right? Because of course, if you know someone else who has racial attitudes, racial prejudices, racial beliefs, yes, please do try and engage with them and persuade them that those beliefs are irrational to hold, right? Absolutely, let's do that. You know, the problem is that I think at this point, by putting all our emphasis on that part of it, we don't see the broader structures that actually can exist without the majority of people in a society actually holding racial beliefs unconsciously or consciously, right? Like those structures have an independent existence that we need to focus on and that this way of thinking about anti-racism doesn't allow us to grapple with. You know, the Sivanandan, the anti-racist thinker, you know, originally Tamil Sri Lankan, but spent most of his working life in Britain. He used to talk about how getting a white person to be able to interact in a normal way with human beings who aren't white is obviously something we want to try and achieve, right? Get rid of those prejudices, get rid of those kind of patronizing attitudes, whatever else it is. But to get to that point is, you know, he would say that's potty training. You know, like, well done. You've got to the point where you're able to function like a grown-up human being. Welcome to humanity. Now let's get on with dealing with the real bigger problem, which is the structures, right? That are to do with things like policing, things like borders, things like military violence, things like mass incarceration, things like the vast economic disparities, both within countries like Britain and the United States and between those countries and the global South, right? Now, that's really where you know, the real violence of racism starts to hit people. That's where, you know, when you're talking about removing every year a million Mexicans from the United States and trying to remove them back to Mexico, that's mass violence that isn't even about individual prejudices and unconscious biases. Like we can get the immigration officer in the United States to do all the you know, diversity awareness, unconscious bias training we want. That deportation officer is still going to be deporting that Mexican. They might do it a little more politely. That's wonderful. But they're still going to be basically deporting that person. And that deportation is inherently a violent process, right? And that's going to be happening to a million people every year anyway, irrespective of the training we give to those officers. Why? Because what drives that deportation is not anyone's unconscious bias, even on a mass level. What drives it is the need in the world to maintain a racial division of labor between the United States and Mexico, so that, you know, corporations can cross that border from El Paso to Juarez, essentially the same conurbation, but divided by a border, cross over there and find workers who can be made to work in the same work for a fifth of the wage that they have to pay on the US side of the border, right? And so that super exploitation is enabled by the border, and the border is inherently has racial meanings because it is understood to divide two different racial groups, right? The US and Mexico. So that's what we need to grapple with if we're gonna transform these kind of deeper structures in a country like the United States. And of course, the same applies to the UK.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared. And to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
You kind of touch on capitalism's role in it, but I was wondering, can you tell me how neoliberalism fits into this?
Yeah, so we have, I think especially nowadays, liberals and the left has this sort of standard story of what we've ended up calling neoliberalism, right? And so I think most people are aware of this kind of standard story. And it goes something like this. At some point after World War II, a group of intellectuals gathered together in a place called Mont Pelerin in Switzerland, talking about Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman and others. And they basically, these were thinkers who believed in a free market idea of how to run an economy, how to run society. And they were despairing because they looked around, particularly in Europe and the United States, and saw, a political situation in which there was growing things like the National Health Service in Britain, public housing. You know, maybe a third of British people lived in public housing. The creation of a kind of cradle to grave system of welfare benefits and so on, high taxation attempting to redistribute wealth from rich to poor and so on. And this was the political situation, and they wanted to find a way to overturn that. And so they start networking, they start, you know, putting out pamphlets and so on, developing alternative set of ideas that is a reassertion and celebration of the market as the best way to organize the distribution of resources in societies. They don't get anywhere until the 1970s, when there's a kind of crisis in the kind of welfare state societies of Europe and the United States. Mainly here we're talking about Britain and the United States, this story. And so they take advantage of this crisis, and from the 1970s start to gain political power for their ideas. And then by the 80s, you get Thatcher and Reagan, who, you know, kind of tear to shreds the sort of welfare system that we had, and create this kind of new, highly individualized, competitive kind of society based on the ideas of free markets. And since then, we're all screwed, and we're all, you know, living with extreme inequalities and pitted against each other to compete for everything, right? I think that's a really powerful story. Like, I associate it with writers like David Harvey in his book on neoliberalism. You know, Naomi Klein, The Shock Doctrine, has a version of this story. So, you know, and it's become the kind of everyday common sense for the left. And I think it underpins a lot of what people were thinking about in relation to the sort of movement around Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders in the US. Now, that story captures a large part of the truth of that history. But it misses out something that I think is important, which is that the impetus for the neoliberal transformation was as much about the movements in the global south for redistributions of wealth across the world, And things like the Black Freedom Movement in the United States, which was also in part about a demand for redistributions of wealth. It was as much a response to those kind of movements as it was a response to the kind of growing power of like organized labor within a country like Britain, which is how the story is normally told, right? The crisis of the 1970s is normally presented as a crisis that's brought about by the growing assertions of organized labor, industrial workers within Britain. And so what happens when we bring in this other side to the neoliberal story, the story of the neoliberal transformation, is I think that it forces us to understand that the questions of race and colonialism have always been central to the neoliberal project in a way that is often downplayed, right? And if once we understand that, we can understand how we're in the world we're in today, which is a neoliberal world and continues to be a neoliberal world, but is also a world of neocolonialism and also a world of proliferating racisms, right? Structural as well as political movements that have races central to them, right? If you only have the standard story of neoliberalism, it's really hard to explain how racism has become so strong and how it's been so persistent, because on the standard story of neoliberalism, you know, moving to this world of individualism and markets should have helped us get rid of racism, right? I mean, that's what someone like Milton Friedman would have said: markets are colorblind, right? And so if we're moving to that kind of society of colorblind markets, we should be getting rid of racism, but in fact we don't, right? So I think we need this other part of the neoliberal story to understand that. You know, the neoliberal thinker Lionel Robbins, who is one of the kind of important core thinkers here for the project, has this line where he says, the mines for the miners and Papua for the Papuans are analytically similar slogans, right? So he's drawing attention to the fact that like organized labor and kind of third world liberation movements are basically the same threat to the idea of free markets, right? What happens through the, I spent a lot of time looking through the kind of intellectual archive of neoliberal thought, you know, reading all the stuff that Hayek wrote and Friedman and a few of the others. And the thing that comes across when you do that, I think if you really kind of look for this stuff, it's there staring you in the face, is that all of these thinkers were very focused on questions of colonialism and what happens after the European empires have been defeated, right? From the kind of 1940s to the 1970s, that's the big transformation that's happening in the world. Because to them, those European empires, while they were illiberal, they understand that they were illiberal in certain ways, they also understand that they kind of made a boundary that set limits on what kinds of demands for social justice could be mobilized from colonized peoples, right? So if you're, you know, a member of the industrial working class in Britain in the 1940s, you are able to make demands for social justice, and you are able to mobilize politically to get the government to do things like the National Health Service, right? Huge achievement, right? But if you're, you know, in another part of the British Empire, say you're in India and you're an industrial worker or a peasant worker or any other kind of worker, you aren't going to be able to mobilize to get the British Empire to provide, you know, lifetime free healthcare for you. Because if you do that, you're going to get killed, right? Because it's not a democratic project over there, right? So from that point of view, the neoliberals had a sort of mixed feeling about empire. On the one hand, they didn't like some of the what they perceived to be the illiberalism of it, but they also liked the fact that it set these limits to what could be done in terms of social justice, because they don't like social justice. They like markets, which are not social justice, right? And so their project after the end of the European empires is, how can we come up with a new way of designing the world in which those limits to demands for social justice from around the world can still be upheld, right? And what they do, you know, when they end up creating things like the World Trade Organization, when they end up getting control of institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and when they are able to shape how the US Treasury Department and the US State Department and so on get to shape the world's global system, they do in fact manage to design a world where those boundaries can be established again, so that it becomes impossible for, countries like, in the early 70s, there were demands coming from newly independent countries in the global south for there to be some kind of international economic order that would enable reparations and redistribution of wealth and a trading system that would enable those countries to be able to lift themselves up out of the history of colonialism to provide something like welfare for their people, right? And those moves by countries like Tanzania and Jamaica were blocked by the neoliberals at the international level. They didn't want a trading system that looked like that. They wanted one that seemed to fit their free market model. And so in that sense, they're involved in a neo-colonial project as well as a neoliberal project.
One thing I wanted to ask you was, towards the end of the book, it feels as if there's kind of a call for marginalized communities to kind of come together, not to, put a hierarchy of oppression next to each other. And I was wondering, firstly, do you think that liberal racism has encouraged us to further isolate, from different groups?
Well, I think one of the consequences of neoliberalism is that it individualizes us, right? It encourages us to think of ourselves as islands, and the meaning of our lives is to compete with others in a market to maximize our personal gain and utility and happiness, and that's essentially a competitive exercise, right? And so you see this even in the way that the social media economy is organized, right, where it's essentially a competition for attention between millions of individuals, right? And so then because we also live in a one of the other things that neoliberalism does is it makes us feel pain, right? It harms us in all kinds of ways, right? Because we're not able to really live happy lives and fulfilling lives based on that kind of organization of the world. So we feel pain, right? And what neoliberalism encourages us to do with our pain, because it has this individualizing effect, is to say, well, look at the uniqueness of my pain, right? Look at the uniqueness of my pain, and only if my individual pain is recognized, can I feel fully human again, right? Yeah. Now that's a delusion, because as James Baldwin says, your individual pain is trivial unless it enables you to connect to the pain of others, right? But that's the thing that we find so hard to do. And if we're going to deal with, if we're going to deal with the sources of those pains that we all feel in different ways, right? Then we're going to have to find ways to come together in collectives, because only like collective organized action is able to dismantle structures. We can do as individuals, what we can do is tackle someone else's individual prejudice. Like I can talk to a white person and maybe hopefully get them to look at the world a different way for that one individual, right? Maybe I'm going to have like some kind of anti-racist workshop and we'll do 10 at a time. We're never going to get to the millions, right, that way. And we're never going to transform, even more importantly, we're never going to transform these deeper structures that are rooted ultimately in the whole system of racial capitalism. I can change the minds of masses of people, but those structures will remain. So if we're going to tackle the structures, the way we do that is not through persuasion and education, but through organized collective action in a power struggle against the interests that want to uphold this system, right? Now, once we're on that level, then as you've highlighted, the question is, how do we move beyond me as an individual or me thinking that my particular identity is the most important thing, and that identity connects me to this kind of small group of other people with this shared identity, and anything beyond that is somehow a dilution of the authenticity of that identity, and has to be understood in terms of these kind of temporary
but probably fraught alliances with others, right? So yeah, I don't think that, you know, in order to get that collective action that we need, it's going to be a matter of, you know, the old slogan of black and white, unite and fight. Like everyone can just come together in a kind of shared class struggle that erases any of those differences. Like that's never worked, and it's never going to work. And the reason it never works is because actually differently racialized groups have very different material relationships to these structures of capitalism, right? And so the experience is going to look different. And so therefore it's not an automatic unity. It's a unity that needs to be built, and that requires political organizing and so on, right? But unless we can do a better job of bringing larger collectives together, we're never going to be able to take on these structures.
That makes sense. One thing that I was absolutely fascinated by in your book is this idea that's promoted the English liberal values as this very vulnerable thing to immigration, and this idea that, you know, it's almost on a tipping scale, and, you know, if we have excess immigration from especially non-white countries, English liberal values are at threat. And I was wondering if you could explain how that idea came to prominence and how it's been used, you know, in this argument of immigration.
Yeah, so this is really, you know, the idea of British values, like however you want to define those, actually, whether you define those in liberal terms or even, you know, like I think probably in the early 90s, late 80s, there was a lot of people talking about defining those British values in more conservative ways, like Norman Tebbit and John Major would have done. The basic argument that exists politically in Britain to make the case for ever tougher immigration controls, which is what we've seen since the late 60s, you know, the basic argument is that is a cultural argument, right? It's not one that is about thinking of racial hierarchy in a 19th century way. It's an argument that says, you know, Britain is defined by a certain cultural value system that is not shared by people from Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, Middle East, and that if you allow too many people in from those parts of the world, then that value system will be weakened, and that is dangerous, right? And that weakens the political stability ultimately of the British order, right? Now that argument, which comes from Labour politicians, Conservative politicians, you know, day in day out, and has done for decades, goes back to someone called Enoch Powell, right? Who ends up being presented retrospectively as, you know, someone it's simply a story of someone who was an individual, racially prejudiced politician. Like he didn't like people from South Asia and the Caribbean, and so therefore he wanted to keep them out. And that's as simple as that. And he mobilizes. You know, kind of prejudice and hatred in this fanatical way, and that's the danger he represents. So his story is kind of slotted into this same old liberal idea of anti-racism, right? Which is we have a certain number of people in society with these prejudices, whether they're unconscious or conscious, and a charismatic politician can come along and manipulate those prejudices in this way. And that in the end becomes a kind of threat to liberal democracy because, you know, they kind of push us towards a kind of authoritarian, if not fascist, kind of politics, right? Well, the problem with that reading of Powell is it misses out that not only was he the kind of innovator of this new argument for immigration, but also he was Britain's first neoliberal politician. Right, this is the part of Powell that's dropped off the kind of standard recounting of his life. So before Thatcher and before Keith Joseph and before, you know, these other figures that people tend to associate with the rising kind of political influence of neoliberalism in the 1970s, the neoliberal think tanks and the neoliberal kind of intellectuals that were operating in Britain in the 1960s, you know, you look at the archive, they all talk about Enoch Powell as their one man in Parliament, right? And so he was already making these kind of arguments of the virtues of a free market society. And why this is important is because it helps us to understand where his racism comes in. So his racism is essentially the idea that if Britain's going to do this neoliberal transformation that he wants to see Britain do in the 1960s to get us away from the kind of more social democratic kind of welfare system that we had, you know, what ends up being the Thatcherite turn. If Britain's going to do that, his argument is it's only going to be possible if the kind of collectivist value system that Britain has among its working class is broken down, right? So for him, like culture is central to the neoliberal project, as it is for all the other neoliberal thinkers, actually, like Hayek and Friedman and so on. All of them see culture as a central question. And in Powell's case, his argument is that in order for us to break down this kind of communal collectivist culture that is never going to be compatible with a free market society, it's going to require a kind of cultural transformation to be carried out by the government, right? What Thatcher ends up talking about, as you know, she has this line that she gives in an interview in the early 80s about the sort of political transformation she's trying to bring about is not just simply about economics, but it's about transformation of the soul, right? And that's what captures this idea that it's a cultural transformation that we need. So we get to think of ourselves as more competitive individuals. Now, Powell's argument is that's never going to be possible if you've got a load of people in Britain from Pakistan and India and the Caribbean, because they're really communal kind of people. They're not individualist, right? Their values are, you know, extended family, like looking out for the broader community. And what's more, those cultural values from those other parts of the world are so deeply fixed and rooted that you're never going to be able to change them. They're fixed, right? So for him, culture is kind of functioning like a kind of race-like thing here, because it's so deep, it's not going to change. It's like something that determines all your behavior in a way that looks very much like race, right? And which is why for him, actually, race and culture are kind of interchangeable, right, as concepts. So we need to repatriate, he would say, the million or so people of color in Britain, you know, in 1968, because they are the biggest barrier to the more individualized society that he wants to create, right? Because a million people with those fixed values that support communalism are going to influence their neighbors, the white working class neighbors that they live with, to also be more communal. So we're never going to be able to get our cultural transformation going, right? That's essentially his argument, right? And so it's another great illustration of how the question of neoliberalism, the question of racism get entangled together in this way, right? And also, you know, it points to this, which is, if you think of Powell as just the kind of inheritor of an older kind of Victorian form of racism derived from the British Empire period, and he's like this kind of legacy of the past, this kind of hangover of the past, right? It doesn't explain why the political project that he wants to initiate and that he successfully gets going in Britain, which is the idea of ever tighter immigration controls. You know, like before the mid-60s, it was possible for you to move from the Caribbean or from South Asia to Britain without having, you know, like you had the right to do that, right? And there were no restrictions on you moving in that way, because it was understood that this was all part of the British Empire or former empire. And as you know, like when my father was born in India, he was made a subject of the British Empire. He'd never, you know, like been to Britain when he was born. Obviously, like for the first kind of 30 years of his life, he'd never been to Britain. He had no idea what Britain was about. He had never met someone from Britain, but he was a subject of the British Empire and therefore could freely move to Britain before the mid-1960s, right? And that was the understanding. Now we go from that system to a system of immigration controls tightening year in, year out, Labour and Conservative legislating that right through to the present day, right, where you know we are in the midst of making it even more likely that we have a death by policy in the English Channel, by you know using every means possible to try and prevent people from crossing into this country, right? So that's a new political project, right, that goes hand in hand with the emergence of neoliberalism, right? Tighter immigration controls are an aspect of the growing political influence of neoliberal intellectuals, right? So what we see with that whole infrastructure of racist violence that is what border controls are is something that is not like the legacy of the past, of the British Empire, of some sort of Victorian thing that's been handed down, that survives into the neoliberal era. It is a product of the neoliberal era itself, and Powell tells us why that is.
Before I let you go, can I ask, what are your thoughts on the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman's recent comments about multiculturalism has failed?
Yeah, well, you know, so the idea of multiculturalism has failed is an old idea, right, at this point, right? It's... It was a notion that was first actually put about by by politicians in the late 90s actually across Europe and then it was you know in the sort of years of the war on terror it was repeatedly invoked. David Cameron gave his famous speech about the failure of multiculturalism in what was it, 2009 or 10 or something like that, and during the Blair years and Gordon Brown years every Home Secretary gave that speech, right? And so Suella Braverman is utterly unoriginal in this formulation. The problem with the argument is that multiculturalism has multiple meanings, right? So if by multiculturalism you mean how's it going in say a city like London of millions of people from different ethnic backgrounds living relatively close to each other in different neighborhoods. What's it like when they interact over the garden fence or on the street corner or in the shops or at the school? I mean, the reality is that at this point, there is a sort of conviviality to that that people have fought for. Like, it didn't just kind of spontaneously happen out of some kind of wonders of the British, kind of political and cultural history. It was something that people like us had to fight for, often quite violently, right? Like when you talk to older people involved in anti-racist politics, it's clear that they had to confront organized racism in their neighborhoods, right, across London, in order to for us as their children and grandchildren to get to the point where that's less of an issue than it was, right? Having had those struggles, a kind of conviviality becomes possible, right? And that's, again, now we're talking on the level of interpersonal relationships, right? That stuff about individual prejudices. The potty training. Yeah, most of London's done its potty training now, right? We've got to that point where we can kind of deal with each other as ordinary human beings. But that doesn't do anything about the structural problems, right? The fact that you're more likely to be killed by the police if you're Black. The fact that you're more likely to be deported to a place you've never been if you're Black or Brown. The fact that, that all the kind of structural outcomes like economic inequality, health outcomes, housing conditions, and so on are all racially structured, right? So that's what the picture looks like in the real world. Then there's the question of something like what might be called a multicultural policy program, right? And normally when people give that speech about multiculturalism failing, they're talking about the multicultural policy program, which is essentially this idea that, runs through the period really after the early 80s. So in the early 80s, we had, uprisings, insurrections across Britain, coming out of
Black and South Asian communities, but also involving white people in those areas, set of rebellions against the police, right? In that moment, there's various responses that came from the authorities to that kind of crisis. And one was, we need some kind of multicultural policy program, right? The Home Secretary at the time talked about, we need to give minorities a cultural outlet of some sort to kind of divert them from the political mobilizations that are happening on the streets, right? So suddenly, you get Channel 4 programming with a whole strand for ethnic minorities, and suddenly the news is being read by a Black woman for the first time, and suddenly the Arts Council has a new strand of funding for ethnic minority arts, as it would have been called at the time, right? And so, you know, there was an understanding that you, in order to bring a kind of integration process into play for communities that were seen as excluded, one of the ways to bring them in was to create these kind of institutional settings where there could be some kind of cultural recognition, right? And that's a very neoliberal response, right? Like the idea that, and essentially the word we use now to describe that is diversity, yep. Right? And diversity policy, and that was a neoliberal response, right? So we now have in the United States and the UK a conservative politics that, again, is nothing. This is not actually original, right? This is decades old, but it's a conservative politics that is organized around the idea of opposing that kind of response, that neoliberal response to anti-racist insurrection, right? And all the woke stuff is that's what that essentially is, right? So there is a sort of split in the kind of ruling elites of countries like Britain and the United States. There's a liberal wing that thinks that that kind of diversity policy is the best way to deal with the kind of threat of insurrection, the kind of thing that in the United States we saw in 2020, where 15 million people were on the streets in the Black Lives Matter protests. Like for neoliberals, the best way to deal with that is to do diversity politics, right? Which is not what the people on the streets were demanding. They weren't saying we'd like to have better diversity training in university departments. They were saying we want to defund the police and abolish the immigration and customs enforcement, right? So it's not what the demand was from the streets, but what the response was in neoliberal institutions was, let's do more diversity training, let's do diversification of our management, and so on. Let's do better representation in Hollywood movies, right? You had Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, the most powerful financial institution in the world, talking about systemic racism, right? So an amazing moment, because that phrase, systemic racism, is a phrase that you would also find maybe in someone like Frantz Fanon, what a revolutionary who believes in the armed struggle to overthrow colonialism. They're both using the same term to describe the problem here. Well, they don't mean anything like the same thing by it, right? And what Larry Fink is talking about is like, let's have more diversity training in his corporation, right? Now, there's a conservative wing of the ruling elites that says, no, that's not the best way to deal with these insurrections. The best way is actually none of that diversity. That diversity just makes the problem worse. We don't want all this diversity training. We want to go back to a certain idea that there's one culture, and people outside of that culture are going to have to either be assimilated into our culture, right? Again, it's that they're also neoliberals, right? Their idea is that culture is all about individualism, competitiveness, and so on, right? That you have to assimilate into that culture, or we're going to use violence to force you to behave according to those cultural values, even if you don't assimilate into them, right? So there's a division there on the part of the ruling elite. But from our point of view, as people who we're serious about trying to dismantle structural racism, then neither of those two camps are ones that are going to be helpful to us. And we have to be clear that there is a different anti-racist tradition from the one that the diversity training people are advocating, not least because that tradition of the liberal tradition of anti-racism is indeed patronizing and preachy and elitist. So the conservative criticisms of it
have some validity to them. There's a kernel of truth to it, right? Because it does have this idea that it's about elites educating regular people that they are being irrational in their beliefs, right? Whereas those of us in the radical anti-racist tradition, we despair at the ways that historically white workers have not been able to ally with working people in the rest of the world, right? We despair at that, but we understand that the real problem is not them. The real irrationality is at the top of the system, not regular people. The real irrationality is the way that our world is organized according to this system of racial capitalism, which creates wealth for a tiny few and makes the rest of us suffer, right? In different ways, suffer in different ways, but nevertheless, we're also suffering. Whatever kind of skin color we have as working people, right? So we need to make that distinction, and we need to do this more radical anti-race tradition that is about collective action, not about kind of talking down to people that we think haven't understood the rational way to be.
Thank you so much for your time, Aaron. This was an absolutely fascinating chat. The book again is What is Anti-Racism and Why It Means Anti-Capitalism, and it's available from your local bookshop. I'm Ruchira Sharma, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.